Welcome to Community Conversations, a monthly program on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson, and this evening we'll be talking about the aftershocks of last month's mass shooting in Orlando. It made sense to me that there would be heartfelt reaction in the Northland's LGBTQ community after a man opened fire in an Orlando gay bar June 12th, killing 49 people and wounding 53. LGBTQ, by the way, stands for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer. But not a lot of what happened after I started reaching out to folks to set up this conversation made any kind of sense to me at all. Several people we contacted didn't dare do an interview, even anonymously, for fear they'd be outed, threatened, or hurt as a result. The growing political climate, with what seems to be a pushback against so-called political correctness, has a lot of our friends and neighbors afraid every time they go out in public. A year ago, we were celebrating when same-sex marriage became legal in Minnesota. Have we continued to move forward or back? Tonight on Community Conversations, The Ones Who Don't Dare Speak, Reactions to Orlando in the Northland. Let's meet our guests.
My name is Aaron Olson, and I work in the Office for Students in Transition, and I was also the GLBT Services Interim Student Support this last year.
My name is Dennis Kempton. I was a former director of the Northland Gay Men's Center and also a GLBT columnist for the Reader Weekly and the past co-chairperson of Duluth Superior Pride in 2001.
My name is Denestel. My pronouns he, him, his. I'm currently a student at UWS, openly gay.
The attacks in Orlando were kind of a strange thing in a lot of ways, just about when the country was at a tipping point of hysteria about terrorism. The attacks happened on a gay nightclub, and the perpetrator of the attacks, although ostensibly a Muslim, possibly with ties or an interest in ISIS, seems as though maybe his own conflict about being gay, his own concerns, his own questions maybe about being gay, also contributed to the attacks. Many people here in the Northland, members of the GLBTQ community, continue to be concerned. I think there's a broad range of experiences that people have had. In the folks that you know and the folks that you talk to, how are they reacting to Orlando?
A lot of the people that I've talked to have been kind of shocked and numbed by the entire thing. And you don't know how to process it, because when you process something, it's because you've had it happen before and you can process it faster, but we've never experienced it on this level. And so the actual processing and moving past and moving forward and trying to be somewhat at peace with any of it, I'm not seeing that happen at all.
I think from a lot of people I know, there's a danger in analyzing the situation from not a personal point of view, but like intellectualizing it about how it's an anomaly. But I don't think it's an anomaly. And what's disturbing about it is that the terrorism aspect of it, coupled with the homophobia part of it, or the self-loathing homosexual part of it, it can happen anywhere now. I mean, it's not just large urban centers. It comes to smaller towns. So I think everyone is afraid to encounter the thought that it could happen anywhere, especially in a city like Duluth.
Because of the shooter, from like what I personally believe and have read a lot, is that it was, in a way, internalized homophobia due to religion, even if religion or not was involved. I feel he had a lot of self-hate. It turned out to be, from my perspective, a ticking time bomb. The minute that he started to hate himself, it started a clock for this to happen. And kind of like speaking to people in the community, because I work in the community, I volunteer for LGBTQ youth with LSS, and I'm on the board Alliance, a GLBTQ group in Superior, so a student organization, and the minute that this happened, we kind of grouped together, and we made our own Facebook message like group, and we started like talking to each other, kind of like keeping tabs on each other and seeing how we're doing. Even our international student heard about news, and he sent us an email and Facebook message to see how we're doing. I think we quickly mobilized to be there for each other. There was a lot of talk of like being stunned, being scared. Even the fact that personally for me, because I'm the only Latino there, I can't really connect with others on that aspect, because there most of these people that were killed were Latino. There's not really somebody I can go to up here to kind of talk about it, but it's like getting the understanding with people, like we're all here to help each other. And I think being like, I recently went to Twin Cities Pride, and there was a lot of like excess morale being given off there, and I felt it. It was like the reason people that did come to the parade and to the Twin Cities Pride is because they wanted to stand up. They didn't want to cower down and be feared that because of this incident that happened in Orlando, we should all hide and cower away. I think it was a more like a leverage to like, there's a reason why we have pride and the reason why we're still here and why pride should always be recognized, why we should recognize ourselves.
I've seen a lot of support of allies, of straight people, white people, Muslims, saying, I am supportive and this was a heinous act. Do you feel that that kind of support exists in this community? Did you see that more from Orlando than you see here in the Northland?
Yes, we have a really strong foundation of allies here, and they really did use their voice, and they did voice their concern, their support. And like being at Twin Cities Pride, you can obviously tell who was allies because they were doing the most. And it was amazing to see. It was a really good feeling that the allies were there, and they were there and loud. So it was really good. It was a really good experience.
What I haven't seen online, which is a little bit concerning to me, is that I haven't seen a lot of personal stories from younger LGBT people or even older LGBT people about their stories, about how they've been fearful over the years, whether they're in their 20s, 30s, 40s, or 50s. I see a lot of support from allies, and that's great, but I do really think it's important for LGBT people to tell their stories as part of the incident of what happened at Orlando. And I don't know why they're not doing that en masse on social media. It could be that, you know, we are kind of lulled into a comfortable time where, you know, gay marriage is now regular marriage. And it seems like part of that struggle has accelerated and come to an abrupt stop. And, you know, I feel now that a lot of the issues are trending towards, you know, helping trans people get mainstreamed into our society. But I don't know if Aaron or Ernesto disagree, but I haven't seen a lot of personal stories on social media about people sharing their experiences, their experiences of being frightened or terrorized in their communities.
I would agree with that. And I think you're right that the gay marriage part becoming just normal marriage instead of gay marriage has added to that we do feel more comfortable. And it's almost as if the older generation kind of feels like
it's done.
They don't need to. And I don't think they realize that how important that is for the LGBT youth to hear. Mm-hmm. And as far as allies in Duluth goes, I think we have an amazing showing going on right now. When we had a vigil, one of the first people to respond was the chancellor of UMD saying, I will be there. It's not something that he's hidden, but his son is gay. And so he makes sure to be an ally because he knows just how important it is.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about the ones who don't dare speak, reactions to Orlando in the Northland this evening. And our guests in the studio are Aaron Olson, UMD Office of Students in Transition and GLBT Interim Student Service Support, Dennis Kempton, Former director of the Northland Gay Men's Center and LGBT columnist for the Reader Weekly and openly gay UWS student Ernesto Soto. I'm glad that we're talking about the idea of stories and the idea of social media, because I went looking on social media for some people that might want to talk to me about Orlando and about what the climate for GLBTQ people is here in the Northland. And there was an overwhelming response of people who did not dare to be interviewed on the air. They didn't sound as though they didn't want to share their stories, but they said, I can't. And they were reacting out of fear. They said they were afraid of the consequences. They were afraid of being outed. They were afraid of being threatened. They were afraid of being physically hurt. I'd kind of put out a call, and I said, anybody who wants to comment, who wants to mention topics that they'd like us to cover, wants to ask questions, something that they want to communicate. And she wrote to me, I would like to hear talk more about family-friend reactions and support. For example, as soon as she found out, my boss texted me to make sure I was doing okay and offered her support. My parents, on the other hand, did not understand how this could affect me, being that I didn't know any of the people, and got upset when I tried to explain the fear I felt. Perhaps as well, you can ask when people first returned to their local queer hangout. I did that night, but the place was almost empty. Finally, ask if people can see this sort of thing brewing in this area. I have certainly seen an increased amount of Islamophobia, as well as people putting down the community for, quote, making it an LGBTQ issue. Are there people, do you think, that feel that this is not a gay issue?
You know, it's such a perfect storm
of
things.
Really,
it's got the Muslim factor in it, which is, I think, is based completely with the religious aspect of internalized homophobia. You've got the mass shooting impact of it, which is something everyone's frightened of. It's part of terrorism.
Right.
But what really struck me with what you said, with people were afraid to come out and tell their stories or get involved in it. You know, UMD is such a, you know, you've got Aaron here who works at UND for these kinds of issues. And I'm struck by, you know, I was a freshman in college in 1992. That was a feeling on campuses at that time.
Yeah.
So we're in 2016, and you live in a community where people are afraid to, I mean, we didn't have social media in 1992. There were a few outlets for us to come together. The clubs were, I mean, we had a very lean LGBT campus organization at William & Mary, and, you know, but that was considered extremely liberal school for the Southeast. But if that was going on in 1992, and that's still a remnant here in 2016, that's really, we think we've come a long way, but we have not, I don't think.
Well, and something that surprises me based on what you were just talking about is that I've seen the transgender community at UMD be very out and very, very loud and very, very present. And so I'm wondering, you know, the people that are saying, like, I can't tell my story or I can't be interviewed, it makes me wonder if it's a remnant of that feeling in 1992, sort of that generation where you don't want to talk about it because you could get fired or you could have ramifications because of it. And I don't know if that's as much of a thing as it used to be, because we do have laws protecting you now for those kinds of things.
I don't want to put words in their mouth, but the people that were communicating with me, it seemed as though there was a very real fear of physical violence.
Yeah,
of somebody coming
after,
of right now, today.
The political climate is feeding into that.
Absolutely.
And that's why some people don't want to delve into thinking that this is an attack on the LGBT community or has anything to do with an LGBT identity. They would rather say that it's about terrorism. Because capitalizing on that fear and separating people out, whether you're Muslim or gay or lesbian or especially today trans, that is something that more people tap into than confronting the homophobia that still exists in the United States, along with rabid racism these days. I think the fear is very real and it's valid. And the more people talk about it, the more it becomes acceptable for others to step up and say, you know, this is something that we may think about. But, you know, the thing they say about Trump is that he says what's on his mind, and he's only speaking for what the American people think. So the more people hear that in the media, the more they think, well, you know what? It's okay for me to come out and say that too.
Yep.
And that increases the fear exponentially for LGBT people, Muslim people, what have you, if you're not white, male, Christian,
yeah,
in this country.
Here is a comment that came via someone else through social media, was asked to be passed along to me from a transgender woman of color. And she shared, acknowledge that trans people of color have faced the brunt of this attack and how difficult it has been to find someone to interview because of this. And I had shared how difficult it was to find someone in a part of that community that was willing to come on the air and talk. Say that in looking for someone to share how the Orlando shooting has affected them, I was met with people afraid to show their face or even give an anonymous in-studio interview. It could just as easily have been them in Orlando, and that fear comes from the crosshairs being put on their back for speaking up. The fear comes from being another statistic. Are people targeted because they speak up, or are people targeted because, oh, now I know who you are, and now I can target you for being who you are?
Both.
Yeah. I think
it's a combination.
Yeah, I agree as well. It has to do because it's easy to separate people. It's really easy to separate people. Once people get united, then they start to target the leaders. And that's like one aspect of it. Because either it's like individualized where you're out on the street and you're having a conversation, somebody comes by, and they look at you and you don't look, I guess, quote unquote normal, they will confront you and they will put you on the spot. And I've seen that happen before. Not within the Twin Ports, but that doesn't mean it doesn't happen in the Twin Ports.
True.
Right? But back in Illinois, I've seen that quite often where people get brave and they just step up to somebody and they said, what are you? And that's the question that's always asked. What are you? Not who are you, or in a polite way, like, how are you doing? It's just the direct question, what are you? People either cower down and not say anything and walk away, or they step up as well and the violence escalates. And so it's kind of, it's daunting. It is.
What are you? I'm trying to imagine what I would say if someone confronted me, belligerently or not, and said, what are you? But I wouldn't know how to respond to that. And yet if somebody walks up to you, or maybe to you, or maybe to you, and says, what are you?
We have an answer prepared. We
do. Right.
Because we've been asked that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because, and the beauty of it is you haven't had to. But we have.
Mm-hmm.
If someone were to ask,
beauty, that's awful.
Well, but I'm
saying, but I understand what you mean. But I mean, I understand, but that is awful.
It is. I mean, if someone were to ask me, what are you? I would say, well, I'm a cis gay white man.
Mm-hmm.
A cisgendered gay white man. That's me. Because I've had to, like, I have to know that. I have to accept that privilege as well.
You know, what makes it, you know, someone asked me, you know, why would you talk about what's going on in Orlando if you live in Duluth, right? I mean, that's a valid question, but people don't realize that Orlando isn't just Orlando anymore. It's right on our computer at home in Duluth, on our social media, on Facebook, on Twitter. So there really is no place that's too far away to feel like you're there experiencing it. And the thing about people being afraid to come out and talk about it, or, you know, the fear of reprisal or being challenged in public or what else, that there's a different flavor to it now.
Mm-hmm.
They can do it online. And they can...
With no repercussions.
They can harass you and threaten you when you're in your own home online.
You know, I have a friend who is, I believe, a genius, who said, who came out right after Orlando and said, I am taking the FBI's if you see something, say something edict seriously. If you are gay bashing or LGBTQ bashing or threatening me or threatening anybody or making comments about XYZ person, people should be shot, I will report you to the FBI.
That should always be happening. And there are all kinds of bashing that happened before Orlando and will continue to happen after Orlando. And that should have been reported every single time anyway.
And it's so, not just like threats.
No.
It's if someone makes a comment on a news story. I saw someone make a comment on a news story about trans people using the bathrooms. Yeah. And the comment was, so if men stand and women sit, what do transsexual people do? Squat. I mean, isn't that just as much as a threat to any, you know, why aren't we reporting those things? And I know because I work in PR now, so I work with social media all the time. But if you report that to Facebook, nothing's going to happen. It's a freedom of speech thing, but, you know,
yeah, it is.
To trans people, it's a threat.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about the ones who don't dare speak, reactions to Orlando in the Northland this evening. And our guests in the studio are Aaron Olson, UMD Office of Students in Transition and GLBT Interim Student Service Support, Dennis Kempton, former director of the Northland Gay Men's Center and LGBT columnist for the Reader Weekly, and openly gay UWS student Ernesto Soto. I've had this question in my mind, and I'm disappointed in you, gentlemen. I'm disappointed that you're gentlemen. I realize that I'm asking the wrong people, but I want to ask anyway. Why aren't women who are gay shooting people up, threatening people?
Ooh.
That's a very good question.
That's a great question.
All I can think about is the religious aspect of it and what happened with the Muslim, you know, the guy who was Muslim who did the shooting. Now, you know, people can take their best guess about why he did that as far as his internalized homophobia. But, you know, if you go back and study the texts, you know, people say that a lot of the biblical commandments are about sex, mm-hmm. but it really is about power. In the ancient world, you know, it was about, you know, the actual Hebrew text. I'm Jewish. I'll do that as a disclaimer. But, you know, the actual Hebrew text commands men. It's about men not mm-hmm. lying the lyings of a woman, not being submissive, not giving up their power.
Right.
Women are never mentioned in the Bible when it comes to that because they were powerless in the ancient world. So, I mean, that might have something to do with it. But I think men act out about it most because for centuries, it has impacted what their masculinity is. It's a direct challenge to their masculinity. And it's proscribed religiously, you know, do not do this. It puts you in a submissive. It takes away your power. So I think maybe that's something where more men are apt to act out against it than women are.
I see that part. And then I also see the part that, you know, just regular lesbian women are pretty much sexualized and therefore seen as less threatening already. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like they don't have to have that kind of violence
right.
to help anything they have because it's so much more acceptable for two women to be lesbians mm-hmm. and show the affection that they'd like to show
right.
in public.
And it is sexualized in pornography.
It right? is super sexualized. Yeah.
Why is this the ultimate turn-on for straight men? Why is the idea of two women being with one another in that way the ultimate turn-on for straight men, and yet it's the ultimate anathema also if it's two men?
Mm-hmm. It goes back to that power.
Yeah,
power.
It's the power.
They've also talked, and I'd like to kind of conclude a little bit with the idea of mental health. They've also talked about how women turn depression inward. Mm-hmm. Men externalize it. They take the ugliness, the pain, the rage, the self-loathing, and they frequently turn it outward to other people. I just had a conversation recently with our representative, Jen Schultz, and she said that they were able to do some for mental health issues legislatively, financially, not as much as she would have liked to do. Do you think also that in addition to what's already being done, there needs to be more money allocated for kids that are struggling or maybe not even struggling with their sexual identity as much as they're struggling with the way the world is treating them because of it?
And a lot of that, like, it has to do, I feel like, the education with that and, like, hoping has to happen at an early age because that's where we're at such an early age, like adolescence, we're like sponges. We suck everything in. We necessarily don't know how to interpret this information and how to take in these experiences and how to deal with these experiences as well and who to go to. And a lot of it, yeah, it's internalized and they do self-harm to themselves. And, you know, there's not that support system that they have to, like, really kind of, like, help alleviate some of that pain that they're going through. And it, after some time, it just builds up.
Do you think that there is a perception amongst GLBTQ people that if they go to see a therapist because it's no fun getting beat up every day, that the therapist is instead going to try to talk them out of the identity that they know they have?
For so many years, they did. Yeah, many years.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting because I don't take it that way. But
I don't either. But
right. I think that local therapists need to. I think the area does a poor job therapeutically with practices and individual therapists by identifying themselves as LGBT safe therapists or
yes.
trans friendly therapists. Right. If you talk to anyone in the community and even other professionals, even involved with like the Minnesota AIDS Project or something, mm-hmm. they don't know. Like, you know, that I hear like, I know one guy, you know, but I don't remember his name. I'll try to find out.
It's kind of like a crapshoot.
If you look for a therapist because you're afraid, because you're being bullied, because your life has to accommodate all of these things that should not be accommodated at all, you still have to check with other people and make sure that you vet the therapist first because they may sit you down and try to.
Or even find one.
Or even, yeah.
That's more of the issue mm-hmm. than anyone trying to do any reparative therapy or try to talk you out of it. Or
you want to know before you go in because there are so many people with different opinions on different things that it might be counterproductive to go to someone who has that.
It's not about so much about
opinion.
Being safe, just finding someone who is culturally competent.
There's a stigma attached to it that, you know, something's wrong with you. And so then you're trying to find someone who is not going to tell you that.
Right.
And and it's such a big deal to find someone already, then you're really trying to make sure that it's going to be a good experience.
You know what I find is interesting, though? I mean, it's so difficult to find an LGBT-friendly or culturally competent therapist in the area, but there are some really open, out-there, accepting clergy
yeah.
in the area yes. that are more accessible and more right. and easier to find than someone sitting in an office at any of the therapeutic agencies or clinical agencies in the area.
There's a listening audience. Is there anything else before we're done that you want them to know?
I want them to know that they can ask questions. If someone were to come up to me and ask me, like you approached me about doing this interview, and I didn't know why you were calling me, but then, you know, you said why, and it was like, okay, that makes sense. And so I would like people to know that they can ask other people questions, and it's not necessarily an intrusive thing, but it's a trying to become more culturally competent type thing. So ask questions. If it's something that is asked with respectful tone, it will be taken as such. Someone can ask me something that has the completely wrong terminology attached, and that's fine because I know if it's asked respectfully, I can overlook that part and then educate past that. But for me, it's just ask questions. Ask questions because if you just assume, we all know the whole, if you assume, it makes an ass out of you and me.
I want people to realize that the road is still a long and arduous one. If you're a white male or a white female and, you know, it's been a year since marriage was declared equal and legal across the U.S. For a lot of people, that's where it ended for them. And that, oh, it's okay now. You know, we figured it out. But if anything, the bathroom issues, the trans issues, mm-hmm. the shooting in Orlando, what's happening in the political climate, just shows that the road is much longer than we thought it was.
Yeah.
And to not lose sight of that just because you're of the predominant culture doesn't mean that there are many people who still live in fear every day to which marriage has no meaning to them when it comes to their work and their lives.
I got one word, perseverance. And I say this because a lot of it is kind of like learning from your experiences and kind of like getting through these obstacles you have in life, because everybody has obstacles, some a lot more difficult than others, and sometimes they need support from. And especially what I've seen in after the Orlando shooting, I've seen a lot of perseverance, people rallying for each other, people grouping and speaking their mind and going to social media and expressing their views, their personal experiences on how this has affected them. And a lot of it will always be, how can we get through this versus dwelling on what just happened. And that's what perseverance is all about, is getting through it and becoming stronger after this experience, and I like it, and I use that word quite often because not many, very many people like know, you know, not very many people like kind of think about it, like they think it all, they're not very optimistic, and honestly, like optimism will get you a long way, you know, in situations like these, and I honestly do say that because if you're dwelling, you're not living. And if you're being optimistic, you're finally clearing your head from all these negative thoughts and these feelings, and you can finally see the true picture. You can finally see what is in front of you versus what is behind you. So, perseverance is my word.
Community Conversations is a monthly program here on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. Thanks to our guests, Aaron Olson, UMD Office of Students in Transition and GLBT Interim Student Service Support, Dennis Kempton, former director of the Northland Gay Men's Center and GLBT columnist for the Reader Weekly, and openly gay UWS student Ernesto Soto. Community Conversations is produced by Lisa Johnson and funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.